Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, welcome back to the show. Thank you for being on twice in a row. Good to have you with us.
Hello, Nicholas. It's always nice to be back, even if it's twice in a row. Thank you.
And we are also joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And good to be joining you too. Nice to see you, Anlu. I haven't been on the show for a while with you. I see we're all actually, this is a Cape Town, all Cape Town affair, actually, isn't it?
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. So we will try to keep our mind on the rest of the country and not give you too much of a smug, Cape-infused broadcast.
Exactly.
Let's start off with a piece written by Christopher Rutledge on the DA and economic, on employment equity. So Christopher Rutledge is the executive director of the Mining Affected Communities United in Action and Women Affected by Mining United in Action Advice Office, which is not a title that rolls off the tongue. But anyway, he's had a big go at the DA for what he describes as a cynical attempt to destroy employment equity and transformation. I'm going to be quoting from the piece here. The DA claims that race-based redress fuels unemployment. It is a seductive argument, but a false one. If economic exclusion were the fault of transformation policies, mining-affected communities sitting atop trillions of rands in extracted mineral wealth would be thriving. Instead, they are living proof that the economic engine of SA continues to enrich the few at the expense of many. Overall unemployment across the audited mining-affected communities stands at 72%. Among young people, the rate climbs to an astronomical 83%. He goes on to say, these figures are not aberrations. They reflect a structural economy that was never dismantled, only rebranded. Communities are promised jobs, development, and inclusion. What they receive instead are ghost projects, exclusion from planning processes, and pollution of their land, air, and water. Meanwhile, mining companies continue to post record profits, more than 1 trillion rand in turnover in 2024 alone, and channel those to shareholders and politically connected elites. This is a, quote, crumbs economy in action. He says, the DA wants to erase this context. It argues the Western Cape, with its relatively low unemployment rate, proves that employment equity is unnecessary, but this narrative collapses under scrutiny. Stats SA's latest data shows that the city of Cape Town has an expanded unemployment rate of 32.9%. In the non-metro parts of the province where many black and colored residents live, discouraged job seekers and youth unemployment are well above the provincial average. The DMA point to macro level metrics, but on the ground, racialized poverty remains entrenched. SA's future lies in ensuring that policy like employment equity are strengthened, enforced, and reimagined in ways that empower those who have been structurally excluded for generations. This is what I think quite an amusing line. But let us not pretend that the problem is the DA alone. And here he turns his fire on the ANC, saying broad-based BEE could have been a transformative tool. Instead, it became a looting platform captured by political elites, abused for tenders and patronage, and weaponized to justify wealth accumulation by a few in the name of the many. We must be clear, the failure of BEE does not mean redress is unnecessary. It means we need to rescue redress from elites who betrayed it. Anyway, you can go read the full piece if you are so interested. I believe it was on, Business Live. I'll check that. Yes, Business Live. But, I mean, what's interesting about this piece to me is that, firstly, I think it shows how the debate on BEE has changed somewhat. And, Michael, I'll start with you. But that there was a time when the sort of failures of BEE to actually uplift South Africa's population were not really even talked about that much. We just sort of talked about the intentions of the policy. Oh, we need this because otherwise, you know, we're never going to change the economic conditions of the country. And he highlights some very real problems, the incredible levels of unemployment in parts of the country, the fact that, you know, you have communities that live over this particular wealth, mineral wealth around the country, who are, you know, not really succeeding are trapped in horrendous poverty. But then there are all these other little problems. I mean, firstly, attacking the mining industry for sort of like turnover or making too much money. I mean, this is an old kind of socialist thing, and I don't think it's actually reflective of the real health of the industry of you know, what comes out on the other end. There's the fact that, you know, we already have kind of policies I think that he would be amenable to, in that the government does own the mining rights to these various things, and that it is communities who are actually kept out by those laws, and that if you had private ownership, they might be able to engage with them more. You've got the fact that even in his attack on the DA, city of Cape Town is having a lower unemployment rate or a high unemployment rate. It's still lower than the national average. And this is without the DA controlling the national policy levers, only controlling the provincial and municipal levers. And then he admits to the fact that BEE has been captured by this politically connected elite. But what he fails to kind of connect the dots here in this one is that is, unfortunately, in many ways, a feature, not a bug, of BEE. The moment that poverty and deprivation are not the criteria, but rather race, you create space for those who have already made it to use their race as an excuse to get preference for things, even when you know, most of the people in the country are still being excluded. Your thoughts, Michael? Sorry, I was rambling a bit there, but your thoughts on this piece?
Yeah, I mean, it covers a lot of ground. And I think you're right that, you know, there was a time when there wasn't really enough history for us to look at the cause and effect, or the coincidence, at least, of policy and economic history, economic data. But I think we now are at a point, you know, 30 years on, or slightly less, let's assume, much of the kind of so-called redress measures came in at the end of the 90s, so it's slightly less than 30 years, but still a good period of time. And, you know, the data simply itself calls into question what it is that we're trying to do and what we're managing to succeed at doing. Just last week, I was asked by a national paper to give some responses to the transformation fund. Sadly, the material didn't make the light of day, but nevertheless, it was interesting to me just to kind of synthesize some of the material, some of the research. And you know, you look at he's in fact mentioned some of these things, Christopher Rutledge. But you know, the research we've done has shown that black unemployment has soared from 5.5 million on the expanded definition in 2008, more or less the time when things were really getting intensified on the redress front, to 11.1 million in 2024. Gross fixed capital formation, which is the money and assets which can't easily be moved, so, you know, money that companies invest in the ground, if you like, has slumped from its post 94 peak in 2008 of almost 22%, all the way down to 14.9. 1.5 million South African children are irreversibly stunted by malnourishment. South Africa's economic growth has been anemic, as we know, since 2008, around 1.3%. And youth unemployment has risen to be among the highest in the world, almost 60% for people 15 to 24. So we clearly have a problem. And the difficulty, I suppose, is that, you know, our position is that the problem is quite clearly an economic one. But because the evidence of the problem can be made to look like a racial one, in the sense that race very closely follows class, it is possible for people like Rutledge to advance an essentially racialist kind of argument, or a racialist interpretation of how society works, how South Africa functions. And that really relies on this peculiar idea that a certain number of people, by virtue of their race, are able to exert an influence and retain whatever it is they're retaining for themselves for some kind of benefit. But the argument ceases to work when you look at the economic data. There's no company that's going to be satisfied with 1.3% growth and claim some kind of racial victory when in fact it's losing out, when unemployment is rising to horrific levels, when the taxes are therefore having to be hiked to pay for grants and so on. And then, but if, you know, if one looks on the other side, the vast majority of people are waiting for the better life that they were promised some 30 years ago. And as our own research shows, if we're going to continue growing at a mere 1.3% a year, there's a fancy calculation to do this apparently, and I'm not able to explain it, but I take on trust that that our more clever colleagues have figured this out. I think it's a standard calculation that it'll take at 1.3% a year. It'll take 54 years to double the size of the economy. So that's a quite tantamount to saying to matric leavers in 2025, you're going to have to wait until you're an old person before you have a chance of, you know, gaining some stake in the economy, because at the moment it just isn't big enough. And this to me is really the kind of problem. It doesn't seem fair. Our former colleague Gwenny Gwenya, in fact, made this point too. It actually isn't fair to say to people, look, there just isn't enough in the pie to share our way out of the legacy of apartheid and the legacy of the past 30 years. We, the only thing we can do is to grow the pie. That is literally the only solution that we're looking at. And all the stuff that Rutledge is talking about and the Park Style is talking about, trying to, you know, divide the existing pie up in different ways or new ways, is actually just delusional, because the only way that we're really going to be able to solve our very significant problems is by growing the pie. That's, and all the data points to that.
No, I think that's exactly correct. And Anlu, you know, what's frustrating about these kind of attacks on sort of a non-racialist approach to these things is they say, well, no, you see, BEE has failed, but that doesn't mean we should get rid of BEE. We must just replace it with something grassroots up, I think is the phrase that Mr. Rutledge uses in this piece. But it's a similar, you know, that argument is made all the time that we must have. And in fact, one of the B's in the ever-growing acronym of BEE is broad-based, right? It's supposed to be broad-based. But, you know, this is by its nature. But then when we actually start talking about whether BEE is being complied with or what the new targets are for BEE, what's the focus? It's always top management. It's always what company ownership is supplying things. It's never like, you know, unemployment. It's never focused on the poorest people in society.
Yeah, it's exactly as you said, Nicholas. The argument that the guy is putting forth here, excuse me, I just want to take out one earphone, I'm hearing myself quite loudly. The argument he's putting forward is exactly that BEE is not the problem. It just wasn't executed correctly. And we've heard this so many times. Let's just try it again. We'll try it. We'll do it the right way this time. And what I agree with him is that, yes, it has been captured by the elite and it has to some extent been abused by tenders or whatever. But the problem is that it didn't work because it wasn't executed correctly. It didn't work because the whole concept is faulty. It's based on the same old race logic that South Africans are so fed up with. And I think Michael alluded to this when he pointed to some of our surveys. And when I say race logic, what I mean with that is racially classifying us and requiring us to tick little boxes. South Africans are fed up with that. And as long as we have these regulations that actually require us to racially classify, we're using that exact same old apartheid style classification to regulate who gets hired and who doesn't get hired. And it's this kind of thinking that it doesn't only uplifts nobody, and it just basically reduces us all to that little tick that you make in the box. And there's another argument that it just completely frustrates me every single time I hear it. And it's this that employment equity is still needed. And every time I hear it, I question, what do you mean with it? Are you implying that Black South Africans can't compete unless they're given a leg up? Because I find that very insulting. And then believe the big issue that he's not really addressing here is just that on top of all the actual fault with BEE in principle and employment equity in principle, is that it's expensive. And I'm not necessarily just saying that it's expensive in terms of money and BEE premiums. What I'm saying is that every minute we spend on complying with this nonsense, it's a minute that we're not spending on doing the actual work, and it's a minute that we're not spending on building our country and innovating and growing the economy. And we know that growing the economy is the most important part, because that's the only way to actually uplift all of us at the same time. It will benefit all of us, which is the point that Michael also made. Michael mentioned the 54 years, and I just want to quickly, just a small little point, it's like a rule of thumb, essentially, that if you dividing 70 by the growth rate, percentage growth rate, then yeah, you'll get the amount of years that it'll take. So yeah, I think the piece, it mentions some of the problems, but I don't think it gives the right solutions to how to then address those problems. And redoing BE is definitely the solution.
So, Michael, just to close on this one, you know, the word transformation is thrown around a lot by government. It's thrown around by business, in the policy space. And I think you, Michael, have made a really good case for sort of reclaiming that word, because it's a very slippery word in that, you know, no one knows exactly what it means. Does it mean that you are changing the society so that all South Africans have a decent opportunity to have a stake in the economy, that all South Africans live in a wealthy, growing, forward-looking, innovative, peaceful society? Or does it mean changing the top level of racial ownership of an organization so that it complies with some social engineering project? And you'll see the government sort of, in particular, play kind of both sides. It'll use each of those definitions as it needs to when it's talking to business. It says, no, what we really want to do is change the environment and give poor people a chance to be in the economy and uplift people with skills and that sort of thing. But then when they're talking to an internal ANC audience, suddenly it's all about ownership and racial box ticking and that kind of thing. So just your thoughts on what it really means to transform society.
Yeah. Because inevitably, I mean, your last point, you know, is what the government is really focusing on, and that forces all of the economy to focus on, is who owns what, you know, who are the movers and shakers in companies. So immediately it sort of elevates the attention to a level of society that is important. I mean, the leadership of companies and so on. But it's quite discreet. We're no longer looking at what Rutledge refers to as racialized poverty. But if you look at racialized poverty, and I'm just going to actually quote myself here from my notes that I referred to a bit earlier in response to a media query last week, where I made the point that it's not the color or the racial complexion of enterprises or investments that determines their contribution to the well-being of South Africa or South Africans. It's whether they are successful or not. Success is actually what is transformative, because by every conceivable measure, because this is measured in jobs, taxes, in the ground investments, literally building stuff, foreign earnings, opportunities, social and economic mobility, optimism, rising living standards, and more, this is probably the most critical thing, more and more better daily choices for millions of people. And that is really the dynamism of any free society or any growing economy, is that it doesn't rely on the little group of Politburo central planners. It relies on the freedom that millions of people actually have in their hands to make daily choices, not just a single choice, lots of different choices, where they go, what they buy, how they travel, you know, what they think about. It's all of that. That freedom to excel is enormously transformative. And the greater extent that you allow it to happen, the greater the transformation in your society will be, and it'll be the kind of change, the real transformation that people actually choose for themselves. So it's, you know, it establishes stability, optimism, options for the future, dynamic economy, and all the rest of it. So I'm glad that you asked me to reflect on that, because I think it is that is really, you know, what transformation ought to be, and it's the very opposite of what we've been given in the post 1994 period, tragically.
All right, let's move on to our next topic. And this is about Minister Parks Tau, Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, who has announced that under a new block exemption, entities in the logistics sector can coordinate on rail repair, maintenance and upgrading. There were competition protecting rules that prevented a certain amount of collaboration between these companies, but Parks Tau has relaxed those rules in the port and rail network sector as part of efforts to get the country's underfunded and underperforming logistics sorted out. This will be in place for 15 years, which is a good long while, so companies will be able to plan around that. And entities will be able to coordinate on repair, maintenance, and upgrading of port infrastructure, including joint funding of these projects. Companies can also collaborate on, quote, procurement and sharing of services of independent technical experts and other independent consultants for the improvement of port infrastructure. On the rail front, entities will be allowed to coordinate on sharing capacity on locomotives, synchronize the use of rail and port facilities to reduce congestion. This exemption extends to key feeder road corridors of the country's logistics network. Sounds good. I think this is probably a positive step forward. But the sort of question remains is, you know, like, why aren't we expanding this logic and these exemptions more broadly? If these are going to help the sector of the economy, shouldn't we expand them even more rather than just saying, oh, no, you see, it's only the logistics that we need to sort out. Everything else can continue to run along sluggishly. I don't quite understand the logic here. But anyway, Anlu, your thoughts on this story?
Yeah, so the funny thing is, by them acknowledging that they need some exemptions, isn't it like a little bit ironic that they need exemptions in the first place? Like, why do you not just have the policy, whatever, in place so that you don't need the exemptions in the first place? But anyway, so yeah, the hope is here that it will help resolve some of the coordination or communication issues that currently exist between the entities. But I really liked what Gina said in the comments, which is that this isn't forward thinking, it's reactive. And my query with the whole exemption or block exemptions is that they still say that firms who want to enter into these agreements first need written approval from the Competition Commission to say whether these agreements fall within the scope of the regulations that before they can actually act on any of these agreements. And the problem is that they're essentially saying that somehow we want you to collaborate and coordinate, but under government oversight. So it's still that, but under government oversight. And they hope that they will see better outcomes. So I think the issue is that it still ignores why the system is broken in to begin with, the absence of properly functioning pricing mechanisms. I mean, decades of state inefficiency, corruption, zero accountability, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think if Rail and Port Network actually operate in a free market, we wouldn't need these block exemptions in the first place, and bad operators would fail, good ones would raise, etc. That cycle continues itself. I think the block exemptions, what it does is it kind of puts in place these inefficiencies, and it just says, okay, but now we have more hands on the control, so we'll make sure that it functions better. I think if these exemptions end up actually allowing the private players to get involved and to help fund the infrastructure and to bypass some of Transnet's red tape, then it will be a step in the right direction. But I don't think it's a big enough step in the right direction yet.
Michael, any thoughts to add before we
move on? Yeah, I mean, just extending that idea, and I think Andrew's absolutely right. To, you know, it does raise, as Gina is too, it raises the question, you know, if you're making these exemptions, how about looking at the original and saying, well, do we really need this at all? You know, there's a completely different approach. And I think this applies probably right across the economy. Is this reluctance to acknowledge and to allow the free market dynamics, which can be risky, They require perhaps some measure of vigilance, but in fact generate such benefits just by virtue of their sort of built-in mechanics. And I think the reason for that is that generally participants in a free market, people who are taking part in logistics and on the scale that we're talking about here, are people who do recognize that their own self-interest depends on the self-interests of others. And there's a, you know, there is an accommodation, there's a built-in accommodation to these kinds of things, the complex relationships, but they're not reckless relationships. And when they are reckless, they fail. So I think there is, you know, quite a good understanding within the free market generally that the thing functions if everybody buys into the kind of basic standards of how it works, basic understandings, and the objectives are much clearer, that you don't need to constantly check yourself against some or other government checklist and now in this particular case government exemptions. You know, so it's just a, it's a kind of complication of something that could conceivably be much simpler if the government were to able to bring itself just to trust the dynamics of a free market.
All right, let's move on to our next story. We don't have a lot of time yet, but I thought it's worth, Michael, you hearing some of your observations on this particular story. Deputy President Paul Mashatile, who is now in full campaign mode for leadership of the ANC, was speaking to the handover of title deeds to people in Mthatha in the Eastern Cape on Friday, and he was talking very tough about the use of the Expropriation Act for land justice. Quote, whether they like it or not, quote, we shall use the Expropriation Act as a tool to advance land justice. Land justice. I know that some do not like this act, but we will implement it whether they like it or not. We are implementing this act not to spite anybody, but to give back dignity and resources to our people. He then also talked up the value of title deeds, saying that they represent more than a piece of paper. They represent pride and dignity. Title deeds provide clear ownership. We want you, the claimants, to use land productively. So, two things here, Michael, before we get to your observations on this. One is that, you know, the irony is, of course, that the Expropriation Act is not applied just to the possessions of white people. It is applied to the possessions of anyone who government thinks should lose their property in the public interest. So firstly, it undermines the property rights of all South Africans, in fact, also even foreigners as well. But more than that, you know, I think it's very good the president is, or the deputy president rather, is talking up the value of title deeds. And I think that is very correct. Title deeds are an important part about empowering South Africans. But it's sort of small potatoes when you consider, firstly, that there is huge piles of state land in the kind of like tribal trust areas and things like that, that are not handed out as freehold tenure, that there are no title deeds, that it's all a bit vague. But even more than that, that it has been government policy in places like Limpopo to deny Black South Africans full ownership of land, instead essentially keeping that land under state possession and saying, well, you can't actually sell your RDP house, or you can't use this land for anything except farming, or we're going to take it away from you if you don't do with it what we want you to do with it, which is not real ownership. So I think, you know, I don't know what the specific details of these title deeds he was handing out at this event were, but to me, I strongly suspect that this is just a little drop in the ocean considering the tide of what most government policy has been, is that it has not been about actually giving title deeds and land rights to people in the country. Your thoughts on this, Michael?
Yeah, exactly. Our colleague, in particular, Terence Corrigan, but others have written at great length about the themes of government's approach to land, and the one of the most prominent ones is this reluctance to, in fact, pass title to anyone, to acknowledge the importance of property rights in the hands of individuals. The very striking case, of course, David Rakgasi, successful farmer who battled for more than a decade, possibly even 2 decades, I forget the details now, to get the title to the land that he was farming successfully, and the government kept resisting. And we know from government documents that their policy is expressly to limit and delay the handing over of property rights. So I mean that and property rights is a key thing. And your point, that it's very unlikely that the people who'd most at risk in South Africa of losing property through expropriation are going to be the wealthy, because they're in the position to fight back. And so on, and they have rights to defend. The real risk is faced by the millions who don't. They have no rights, they have no title, and they have no wherewithal to defend themselves against potentially a local government authority that wishes to use a certain multi-hectare piece of ground for some or other a pet project that is going to, bring in hundreds of millions and deliver wonderful contracts of tens of millions each that this local authority is free to hand out to whoever. The people who are going to suffer from that kind of thing, and that's really where the greatest risk arises, are going to be the poor who are mostly without rights and who face this constant reluctance by the state to acknowledge those land rights. So just a few things, I think, if I should mention them at this point, Nicholas, the few things that we've chatted about before the show. The first is that in the story, and it is a News 24 story, there's a reference to, according to the government, the Kwelana and Kolobana communities near Mthatha lost their rights to their land in the early 1900s through the betterment policy of the apartheid regime. Now, we know the apartheid regime didn't begin until 1948. So if this land was, as it says here, was dispossessed in 1913, it wasn't the apartheid regime. And it sounds like a bit like nitpicking, perhaps, but I think it's very important historically. If you speak about history, you can speak about the fate of people. You've got to be precise. And this is an egregious case of sort of muddling episodes. You can, say whatever you like and anything goes. It's not very good. And part of the reason why it's not very good is that we end up focusing on the wrong things. There was a story just quite recently on News 24, a good news story about this wonderful man in Kells River. I happen to take an interest in it because as I was saying, I'm a closet botanist, who had, during lockdown, begun growing vegetables. And today, a few years later, he's got a business. He's got a small business selling vegetables. He's got a WhatsApp group. He's apparently doing very well. But buried in the story is this crucial detail that the plot of land that he really wants to develop into what is now a budding business, chap standing on his own two feet, really, with the typical South African can-do approach, has the energy. He's putting the sweat into the ground. He's growing all this stuff. He's watering it. He's looking after it. The plot of land that he wants, he can't get title to because the government is resisting. And here we have, this is a real life case of some, entrepreneurial spirit who is stifled in his dynamism, his will, his optimism. What he's confronting is this dreadful dead hand of state resistance. And I think that's absolutely shocking. So I thought that was worth mentioning.
Anlu, final thoughts before we close up for today.
Yes, I really found it not very surprising. I think there's been serious questions being raised about the ability and, more importantly, perhaps the willingness of government to actually hand over title deeds, especially causing the Expropriation Act. And I definitely will not be surprised if we all of a sudden see more and more of these events being made a big spectacle of how good they are doing something that they were in the first place supposed to do. I hope to see, they mentioned in that article specifically, that there will be post-settlement support. I hope to see that post-settlement support that they speak of, because there are plenty examples of communities who receive land or title deeds, but there's absolutely no settlement support, and they actually just end up not benefiting from these title deeds and land. But I think what worries me more is just how casually the government speaks of or frames expropriation as a form of justice, as if weakening property rights somehow helps the poor. It's completely backwards. And I think, well, not that I think, it is a fact that strong, secure property rights is one of the most important building blocks for any economy you wish to grow that economy. Yeah, growing the economy is the ultimate way of improving living conditions for all the people. Yeah, that's my two cents.
Exactly right. Of course, I think one of the things that the way that the government has, the ANC has so talked up the handing out of title deeds. I mean, President Ramaphosa in his last two State of the Nations has talked about title deeds as you know, being an important part of government policy, shows that at the end of the day, South Africans actually agree, I think, far more than many realize with our vision of how society should move forward, and that they recognize the value of title deeds. They know what this means to their lives, and this is what they want, and that's why government is promising it to them, even if it's not really that interested in handing them out. You know, people don't want to live on cooperatives where, you know, they're supposed to, farming cooperatives or community land or something like that. People want something they can call their own, that they can leverage for their own purposes to advance their own lives. And, you know, only when a South African government embraces that truth, that this is what South Africans want, will we actually see a country which is advancing and growing and succeeding. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a wonderful day.